Today's speaker is Zachary Weiner from University of Washington, and he'll tell us about the work he's been doing on this cosmology of electron scalars, as you can see from the slide. So thanks for coming, and you can start.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I should probably thank Jun Wu from afar for inviting me, and I guess also I'll thank Marios, who helped organize early on, he's probably right, well, it's really early in Seattle, but we've basically swapped places because he's in Seattle while I'm here, and yeah, and thank you, Marco, too. Thanks for having me. Yeah, so I'm going to talk about some work that has been going on and on and on with, for good reasons, with Masha Baryakhtar, who I think a lot of you know, and Olivier Simon, on scalars coupled to the electron in cosmology. So, I'm not in unfriendly territory when I say that we've learned a lot from cosmology. Of course, it established the Big Bang model, standard model, hot thermal plasma at early times. It tells us a lot about neutrinos and how heavy they can be. But of course, it raised as many questions as it did answers. You know, we have this mysterious component of matter density that outweighs the baryons. We have no idea what it is. We have dark energy, which is even weirder, and we don't know what it is. And also, we have this, you know, remarkably simple initial conditions, as simple as you could have asked for, except for being zero, that, you know, we largely believe is due to inflation. But of course, it is, you know, simpler than we might have hoped to ask for. But, you know, we can certainly still hope to learn a lot more, and we certainly do when it comes to dark matter and dark energy, identifying their fundamental nature, you know, identifying the energy scale at which inflation occurred, if these initial conditions were generated by inflation, how that connects to the standard model, more about neutrinos. But of course, the CMB is strongly sensitive to the dynamics of the photons and the electrons and the baryons at early times. And so we can also imagine learning something about the standard model and extensions thereof as well. And of course, you know, as we're all probably exhausted hearing about, questions of the concordance of our cosmological model has been called into question by a variety of discrepant probes. You know, we've heard about this to death, and I'm just gonna, just to frame sort of my thinking on this or my approach, I'm just gonna start by, you know, so for what really is in attention? When we're talking about attention in a parameter that is really a, you know, derived parameter of a model. So, you know, you can formulate attention metric, which quantifies how discrepant two data sets are, which is just like assessing, you know, what is the likelihood of this model when I consider both data sets at the same time versus when I take them individually and multiply them together. One important thing to remember is that this has to be marginalized over parameter space. So the existence of one point in parameter space that does the job that you might want is not enough. But of course, you know, when we're talking about attention metric, like, you know, this is essentially a more formal way of stating, you know, how many sigma apart are my inferences of H naught. But I don't know about you, but I don't really care what H naught is. It's not a fundamental parameter. It doesn't tell me anything about physics. I really care about what the data are telling me about models. And so if I want to quantify models, I need to, you know, at least in a Bayesian context, which we are more or less forced into in cosmology, I need to think about Bayes factors, which reduce to a ratio of these joint likelihoods. So, you know, the likelihood including all of my data at once. And it turns out that you can do some simple algebra to write this as a ratio of tension metrics. So say, you know, how I can reduce this Bayes factor to a assessment of how much I improve this tension by whatever tension metric, but I also have to multiply by the individual Bayes factors for each data set. So I have to ask, not only am I reducing this tension, but am I also not destroying the fit to any of the individual data sets that I'm talking about? I'm sure most people in this room are, you know, certainly not surprised or you're very well familiar with what I'm saying, but it tends to get lost, this subtlety, when we read abstracts that say, like, we reduce the H-naught tension to whatever number of sigma. And, it's important to keep this in mind, and I will try to as I give the rest of this talk, this fact as you assess, you know, what we actually know about models and what we don't. This was stated really nicely in a short paper by Cortez and Little a couple months ago. And, you know, they conclude that because Lambda CDM fits our individual data sets so well, it's quite unlikely that you could cook up a model that would both improve the fit to both of those data sets and also reduce the tension. And so they draw the conclusion that this argument favors looking harder for systematics as an explanation of the tension. You know, that's not an unreasonable conclusion to draw, but I will say that it is also true that there are anomalies in CMB data, for instance, that we can't explain within Lambda CDM and that people have not been able to find systematic explanations for. So it is not out of the question in principle that there are ways to improve the fits to, say, the CMB data, to Planck data. And so, you know, sort of thinking about, you know, when you are assessing your favorite model for how it does in your cosmological analysis, keeping those things in mind as how they drive different parameter preferences is important. To sort of summarize this in a different way, if you want to discover new physics with cosmology, you have to better explain the current data, or at least not explain it worse. And to think critically about this, you have to think about what features in the data lack a good explanation with our current models, and, you know, have some judgment as to how seriously you should take those. You have to do that marginalized over parameter space, and that really requires understanding the actual parameters of your model and priors thereof, of course, at the end of the day, computing a Bayes factor if you're going to go that far. And then finally, you know, we're physicists, we're scientists, so you also have to make a unique falsifiable prediction to eventually corroborate your model if you are indeed claiming that it could be a model of our reality. And again, to make the connection between different probes, cosmology, and other experiments that we might do, I think you really do need a microphysical model to kind of understand what predictions you would actually make. Now, a lot of people look at these tensions and imagine, well, we have this whole dark sector that we know nothing about. It's described wholly phenomenologically. Maybe this is our first sign that our Lambda CDM, you know, purely phenomenological, like two or three number description is insufficient, and we've got some beyond Lambda CDM physics that we're detecting for the first time. You know, this could be, you know, weird dynamics of dark matter or dark energy, or like crazy initial conditions, or, you know, neutrino self interactions, something that people talk about. The problem, and of course, there's the standard early dark energy class of models or extra radiation that add yet more dark components to our universe. The problem here is that because you're talking about the dark sector, you kind of necessarily are in thinking about scenarios where you're not going to have independent probes, or at least you're not going to have independent probes outside of cosmology. And so if you can mess around with the standard model somehow, and find a solution that works, then, you know, you've got opportunities in the lab and astrophysics in principle, because we know that the standard model also describes, you know, us, the Earth, stars, and stuff. But if you won't take it from me, then just take it from Master Yoda, who's always warning us to avoid the temptations of the dark side. Little did Luke know that the light side of the force that Yoda was constantly telling him to study harder was really just electromagnetism. Okay, let's briefly recap how the CMB sort of acts as a ruler of the Hubble constant. During recombination, you've got sound waves in the baryon photon plasma that propagate until the moment that they decouple. And that freezes in some acoustic oscillations that propagate to us today. And then we see that on the sky, so we measure it as an angle. So to get that angle, you have to divide by the distance to that last scattering surface. And that is a thing that has a calibration that's coming from, an overall scale that's coming from H0. This is something that needs calibration. And for the CMB, we think of the sound horizon as the thing that we predict and calibrates that ruler. But that distance also depends on the shape of the late universe expansion history. So, you know, how the Hubble constant evolves with time beyond just being some number today. And this is something that, you know, we have distance ladder measurements at a variety of redshift that kind of map out the shape of this expansion history, even if you completely ignore any overall calibration. And so the name of the game is to make the sound horizon smaller so that I make 1 over H0 smaller as well, because that makes H0 bigger. Okay, how do I shrink the sound horizon? Well, if I rearrange the usual integral that we write down to calculate the sound horizon to write it in terms of temperature, then there's kind of two obvious things to do. One is to increase the expansion rate at a given temperature. That makes this denominator smaller. Denominator larger, makes the sound horizon smaller. This is the class of solutions that introduced extra radiation or early dark energy and whatnot. Another possibility is to make recombination happen at a higher temperature or earlier time so that I truncate this integral at, I make the domain of the integral smaller. The temperature of recombination is just determined by the binding energy of hydrogen, so that's kind of fixed in the standard model. But if I imagine that the fundamental constants were different at early times, or there were other, funny things going on that might have caused recombination to trigger earlier, that could be another way to shrink the sound horizon. There's also, sound speed C sub S in there, but it's kind of hard to imagine messing with that without like severely ruining the shape of the CMB. So let's not talk about that. Okay, so let's talk about varying fundamental constants. As I said a second ago, the temperature of recombination is basically determined by the ionization energy of hydrogen, which scales with the electron mass. So if the electron were heavier at early times, the temperature at which recombination would occur would have been higher, and so the sound horizon would have been smaller. This was a proposal a few years ago now. That is, very simple phenomenologically. I'm really only changing one number in my lambda CDM description of the early universe. Turns out to achieve a near perfect degeneracy within the primary CMB just with this one parameter extension. I'll describe that in a little bit. The problem is that once you factor in these low redshift distances, you need something else. In this original proposal, they went with adding some spatial curvature, which I don't think anyone really likes. But even with that, by this H0 Olympics paper, this model was considered to be the quote unquote best candidate by some metrics to resolve the H0 tension. It was the gold medal winner.
I have a question here.
Sure.
Why this change does not affect the sound speed in the plasma?
Why does it affect? Why does it not?
You said we don't want to mess with the sound speed, and the changing of mass of electron. Well, I could imagine could affect the sound speed as well. Yeah.
It doesn't in a way that is bad. I'll specifically talk about that in a little bit. So if you want to ask again later, that'd be good.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Thanks. Okay. All right. So. Now, the one criticism, well, a criticism that you could have of this work is that they just supposed the electron mass was different at early times, and it magically restores to the value that we measured today at some point afterward. Let's think about actual models that could do that. So the goal of this talk is to answer a few questions. What are the actual particle theories that we could write down to achieve this requisite heavier electron at early times? Once I pick a model, do I get additional phenomenology that tells me something about what I can do? What do complementary probes tell me I can or can't do? And then finally, what does cosmology have to say? Okay, so I'll start with the probes and models. Okay. So I'll start first with a few probes that are really just probes of the electron mass. and nothing else, so just measurements that we have of the electron mass at various epochs in history. BBN is the earliest probe that we have of anything, and if you make the electron heavier, you make it harder to scatter into or off of electrons, and so neutron-proton reactions during the decoupling of the weak interactions is altered. Neutrons decay less because they have to decay into heavier particles. And that has the net result of increasing the neutron abundance for an increasing electron mass at the time that helium-4 forms. And you know, you can squiggle out or even do some more detailed calculations to show that the change in the helium yield goes like the electron mass to the 0.4 power, whatever. So if I just do something really naive and take the theoretical theoretical predictions for BBN in the standard model for the helium yield and compare those to, I think this is the PDG recommended average experimental measurement, I can just directly convert that into bounds on the electron mass using the scaling. And that tells me already that BBN does not want me to alter the electron mass by more than a few percent in either direction. I think these are like two sigma limits or something. Again, this is something, this is not like a quantitative analysis, and it's not going to be part of the quantitative analysis of data that I do later. This is more just a, a reasonably good estimate for how much input BBN is giving us.
So is that holding fixed the baryon to proton ratio?
Mm-hmm. Holding fixed everything, yeah. Yeah, I have more to say about that, but not in the hour-long talk. Yeah, I'm happy to talk about it later. Okay, another probe of the electron mass that we have are quasar absorption lines. So this is an old art. You have some background light source, like a quasar, that happens to pass through on its way to us, a molecular cloud, or various transitions of those molecules that depend on fundamental constants in different ways. And so if I compare a bunch of the lines in the spectrograms, I can back out not only the redshift at which the light passed through that cloud, but also what the electron mass would have had to be roughly, or rather how much it could have differed from the value that we know today. And these are like crazy, crazy good. You get part per million measurements of not just the electron mass, but also fine structure constant over redshifts between small and like 4 or 5. So this is another like extremely powerful probe that we have. On Earth, we can do experiments with atomic clocks. Same sort of game. There are atomic transitions that depend on the electron mass. I can look for those changing with time. You can also use pulsar timing arrays as a reference clock to do this. And indeed, the nanograv new physics paper from this June did exactly that. These turn out to not be competitive with the other ones, but they are something that we can do. So all of these combined, these are just measurements of the electron mass. These paint a picture where I've got, this is one of these like double log plots, so like positive and negative above and below the axis, and but varying logarithmically on each side. I've got these. I've got some range allowed by BBN, a very high redshift. I've got recombination happening at redshift 10^3, as we know, and then I've got these quasars at late times, and there are also late time probes. But the quasars essentially tell the story. Yeah.
What constraint do you get just from the optical depth to reionization? Because the Thomson cross-section depends on the mass of the electrons, so you change that as well.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, the optical depth is a bit of a free parameter, right? And I can, not a free parameter, but it's, the modeling of reionization is not something I would consider. I mean, it's a bit phenomenological, right? So I'm not sure how, I haven't really thought about how degenerate that would be with the electron mass itself. But that said, that is occurring in this range where I already have 10^-6 level constraints, so I can't imagine viable models having anything interesting to say about reionization.
Do you know if the Oklo constraint is stronger than this or weaker?
Okay, this is something I've had on my to-do list to look into more. I don't think that specific one. There are meteorites that are sensitive to electron mass, but I don't think the Oklo one specifically is. I don't remember the details off the top of my head.
Well, it's not a meteorite, right? So it's our, natural.
Yeah. Sorry, I lumped these together in my head because yeah. There are meteorites that I think, again, I've yet to look into them in detail, but. Okay, so here's my picture, and again, like this is the this is a log plot, so these blue error bars are actually quite constraining. So what I basically have to do is, you know, have some constant shift in the electron mass up to the point of recombination. Like this is the simplest thing I can imagine, at least, that then goes away at some rate to evade these quasar absorption constraints.
Sorry, to solve H not tension, what delta
MD
over
MD
do you want?
I haven't told you yet, but order percent to 10%.
Okay.
So that's already in tension with BBN, or at least limited by BBN. Yeah. Okay. So whenever I look at, whenever I think about something that is constant, over, you know, cosmological time and then starts redshifting, I think of a scalar field. So let's talk about models with scalar fields. And let's, you know, take the standard model mass mechanism as inspiration, you know, some linear Yukawa coupling. That's the way the Higgs gives the electron a mass. So if I just say there's another scalar field and it has the same coupling and I write it in the conventional form for, you know, parametrizing these couplings for BSM scalars, then that field would induce a shift in the electron mass that, again, this is just parameterization, don't worry about it too much. But of course, it depends on the misalignment, the you know, homogeneous value of the field times some combination of coupling constants. Okay, now let's put that picture of a scalar field onto my constraints here. If I solve the Klein-Gordon equation, I get that the field oscillates, but its envelope redshifts with 1.5 powers of the scale factor. So if I put that on this plot and I pick a mass so that the scalar starts to oscillate after recombination, I'm already in trouble. It's probably kind of hard to see, but there are, some of these error bars are like exceptionally small. So, you know, again, this is just a picture, but there's not likely any viable parameter space for this linear coupling to have a constant electron mass shift during a combination and not also be too large of a mass shift at late times. Okay, before I talk about how I'm going to... Okay, thanks. Before I talk about, you know, where I'm going to go from there, I'll just mention now I've fixed the model, and so I should get some additional phenomenology, and indeed, light scalars coupled to matter can violate the universality of free fall. So these are equivalence principle violation experiments. Proudly, the University of Washington is home to, you know, one of the premier Earth-based labs for doing these, you know, torsion balance experiments. But it turns out that at the moment, the leading constraints come from a satellite mission called Microscope. And an interesting thing about scalars with this linear coupling is that the Earth, say the electrons on the Earth, serve as just a source term in the Klein-Gordon equation. So even if this field existed but did not have any cosmological abundance, the Earth would source the field, and that would, you know, give me some degree of EP violation. And it turns out to put some rather strong constraints on this dimensionless coupling coefficient. Okay, so I'll walk through this constraint plot for a second. So I have the red shaded region that's labeled microscope. That's the leading EP violation constraint at the moment. Quasars have a mass dependence because the heavier the mass, the longer the field has been redshifting, and so that alters the relationship between the mass and the amount of to which the to the field amplitude. So that gives me this diagonal line. BBN is not especially sensitive to, is comparably sensitive across masses, but it's not quite as strong as, or not nearly as strong as microscope. And also the nanograph constraints roughly fall up there. They're not telling me anything new about parameter space, but they are there. Okay, and so what I've done here is I've got mass in the horizontal axis, but on the top I have the corresponding redshift at which a field with that mass would start to oscillate. And so that tells me that this line here at a redshift of 1100 or so is the dividing line between fields that are too heavy to remain frozen during recombination and therefore give me a constant electron mass shift during recombination, and then fields that would not start oscillating until after. And recalling that the amount by which the electron mass shifts is proportional to the, you know, the field amplitude in Planck units times this dimensionless coupling coefficient, I would have to take the field value like crazy large compared to M. Planck and just ruin cosmology if I wanted to viably shift the electron mass by a few percent. So yeah, this linear coupling is out of the question. What about an axion? Everyone loves axions or ALPs. We love them because,
I mean, unless you specifically tune like your scalar, I would expect that you would induce also couplings to neutrino in this setup if I have to restore SU2 invariance.
Mm-hmm.
So do these generic coupling with neutrinos, are these relevant, say, for BBN, or you didn't consider because you aligned the value of the scalar to the Higgs, like zero B?
I'm not sure. I haven't thought. It's a good point about BBN. Certainly, the prior work on BBN did not think about the implications of the SU2 structure. So, I'm not sure. That's a good question. Any other questions? Okay, so axions are coupled through shift symmetric operators, and that restricts the possible couplings I can write down, makes the theory simpler to talk about, protects the lightness of the mass, which is something that I'm just going to have to take for granted for the rest of this talk. But unfortunately, I get a mass shift that goes like the field's velocity and not the field itself. The field's velocity is never constant. It's very, very slowly growing until the field actually begins to start oscillating. So I don't get my constant electron mass shift at early times.
So why do you want constant?
Well, practically for simplicity of the treatment, but it's kind of hard to imagine that. If the electron mass is changing that much, changing so much, like redshifting like a to the minus 1/2 or a cubed or whatever during recombination, it's kind of hard to imagine it doing what we want it to do. Of course, it's going to be most sensitive where the visibility function peaks, there are a few other. There are a few other details about the actual treatment of the CMB with time-dependent electron mass that I'm not so sure are, sort of taken care of in the Boltzmann codes at the moment. Or at least I'm not saying I think they aren't. I just am not sure. So I don't have the ability to make any comments on that sort of scenario at the moment. Yeah.
I had a question about the scalar case before this. So you mentioned that the Earth's square is a source for the scalar field to be unified. Somehow get rid of my cosmological abundance, my expectation value by slow growth. Is that the sort of bound you're showing here, or is this also based on the cosmological abundance we're seeing?
That is the bound. That is the microscope bound I'm showing here, so, and that's why it's mass independent.
So there's no model building
I'm always going to source it from the Earth, so no matter what I drive, my scalability.
Well, if you take the linear coupling then as your model, then I don't think there's anything more you can do. But certainly, I think there are more imaginative things you might cook up.
And actually, the coin bounds.
I don't. Yeah. So I've not thought about those. I'm not aware of them being relevant at these masses. But I.
But the coordinates that you're testing here are probably close to gravity or something, which are.
Yeah. A lot of these bounds that we're drawing here are extrapolated from work that's been done elsewhere, which concentrates on all of the masses that aren't on this plot, because these are not masses that can be the dark matter. So, it depends on the coupling, but the bounds become stronger at lighter couplings. At lighter masses. So it's not easy to immediately translate. Yeah.
Thanks.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Thanks. So. Axions just aren't really going to work for us. And I'll mention just because we hear there's been a lot of work in the last decade or so, or maybe a bit more, on the gravitational effects of axions or axion-like fields, really, in cosmology. And there's no difference between an axion and a scalar as far as gravity is concerned, unless you have a radically different potential, which usually, if you're talking about massive potentials, then we don't. And I'm just mentioning this because I'll be talking about putting scalar fields into a Boltzmann code later. So.
Sorry, I'm confused about that statement. So scalar coupling will be, for instance, a bit force, and then.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought the potential for the axion, isn't it like 1/r³ or something?
No, I mean in the Einstein equations.
Yeah. Oh, in the Einstein.
Yeah.
Equations.
Yeah.
Not the mediator force.
No. Okay. Yeah. Just a completely decoupled axion or scalar.
Because I naively imagine that also the scalar force, just the electromagnetic scalar force, that's a big force that also affects tractor formation, for instance, as here Marco is an expert on.
Mm-hmm.
And for the axons, then you wouldn't have those bounds.
Yeah.
Which actually you're not showing in your plot, but naively I would expect that they are at that same level, right? They're just a big force, and then that affects tractor formation, so it cannot be much stronger than gravity.
But I think here the mass is like. Not like heavy and light example, right? So our results for the fifth force hold for like very light scalars. Here they are not, they oscillate here. So I don't know how they translate in this the bound that we found in this scenario in which the fifth force oscillates at the level of Coulomb. But it's, I don't know how they translate, but they should be there, but I don't know.
Yeah, we should talk more. But I meant to say here is that all these papers that talk about bounds on ultralight axions in cosmology apply equally well to the sorts of scalars I'm talking about here in the absence of any couplings to other degrees of freedom. Okay, so I mentioned a while ago now that linear coupling is no go. I need something that redshifts faster. I need the electron mass shift to redshift faster than a linear coupling would give me. So let's go to a quadratic coupling. As you might expect, the shifting electron mass goes like a different dimensionless coupling times phi, the field, and Planck units now squared. And since phi redshifts like 1.5 powers of scale factor, now I've got 3 powers of redshifting. And that's enough to have a viable cosmology that fits in between my early time and late time probes. Now, going back to the EP violation, people have computed what the effect is for quadratically coupled scalars. You do not get the field background independent constraints anymore, so my bounds will depend on the mass of the field and correspondingly its field value. And you know, long story short, if I put those on a plot, here's what I've got. So I've retranslated the quasar constraints, and the microscope bounds are still quite good, but they no longer kind of preclude any parameter space independently. And so the parameter space that I'm left with, again, at masses light enough so that the field would be constant during recombination, I'm allowed to have, you know, couplings nearly order unity, which means that I can imagine possibly having an electron mass shift that's order percent level. One other issue that I have not mentioned yet is thermal effects. So we're invoking the scalar field to change the electron's mass. It's only fair if the electrons can change the mass of the scalar field, and indeed they do. The thermal bath of through this quadratic coupling, the thermal bath of electrons will source an effective temperature-dependent mass for the scalar. And it turns out that, I'm plotting, the thing that I want to compare this effective mass to is Hubble. That's the black line. And then for a unit coupling, so this D coupling parameter equal to 1, the thermal mass is the colored curves there. And it turns out that for couplings greater than 10-ish, the field will actually oscillate around the time of E plus E minus annihilation. This is a problem for a few reasons. First off, if the field's oscillating and then it suddenly refreezes when the electron and positrons annihilate and go away, in essence, now I don't really have a clean way to map my initial conditions at very early times to even like the sign of the field value at late times.
I thought you showed that the mass is always less than Hubble.
This is for unit coupling. So the colored curves will move up as I increase the coupling coefficient.
But you don't want to, how far up do you want to go?
So yeah, we'll get there. But my bounds are like, or at least the point where these dynamics start to be important are dimensionless couplings of order 10. Or so. I just have some illustrative curves here of the actual dynamics. So the main reason why this is a problem, I'll just quickly say, is that if I want my field to be nearly Planckian at the time of the CMB, but it dropped in amplitude via this oscillation due to the thermal mass, if it dropped in amplitude by a factor of a few, 10, 100, and that means that it's earlier initial condition would have had to have been super Planckian, and that means that it would have dominated the energy density of the universe, and it would have been a whole mess. So, this is not relevant for much heavier scalars. That could be the dark matter, but it is uniquely relevant for us because we have these really light scalars that have really large field values compared to M. Planck. So the takeaway from this is that the dimensionless coupling coefficient, this D, I don't want it to be larger than 10. Now, this is interesting because the electron mass shift depends on this coupling times the field squared, and in particular the field squared in Planck units. And I can write that in terms of the energy density in the field. And then noting that when the field begins oscillating, it does so when Hubble crosses through its mass, so H equals M. I can substitute for its mass, Hubble, and then substitute the critical density. And I find that if I can't make the dimensionless coupling coefficient larger than a few, then I'm going to have to take a field value that makes the scalar contribute meaningfully to cosmology. So the fractional contribution of the scalar field to the CDM density, once it starts oscillating, is going to be order the electron mass shift in percent. So 10% shifting electron mass is in my viable parameter space is going to require a 10% contribution to the CDM density. That will be important later. I'm going to move on to cosmology now, unless anyone has questions in this part. OK.
I have a question. You want to keep pi very small, right?
Well, so, I mean, I, if I wanted to be able to neglect the sort of gravitational effects of the scalar field, then I would want its field value to be small so it has a negligible abundance. But if I'm interested in a parameter regime where the electron mass is shifting meaningfully at early times, that in conjunction with the other bounds that I have on this dimensionless coupling coefficient requires me to take the field value to be large. Not like necessarily much larger than M Planck, that would not be viable cosmologically because it would dominate the energy density of the universe, but I can't take it to be as small as I like without getting rid of the effect.
What mechanism do you have to
use that? Oh, I mean, the initial misalignment is just an initial condition. It's just something I suppose, the same way that we suppose that, you know, these fields as dark matter just have some initial condition that gives them the right relic abundance. And so as long as the coupling is small enough that these thermal effects at early times don't matter that I just talked about, then they will remain frozen until they would otherwise start to oscillate when Hubble drops
low. Phi has another potential, or is it just this piece?
We're just assuming that we just have this quadratic potential, massive potential, yeah.
With the quadratic potential, there could be a screening effect. So like for that microscope experiment, the local electron density could lose the mass. Is that?
That's taken into account, yeah.
That's part of why it's relaxed, the constraint?
I think the main reason why it's relaxed is I think the screening effects are not, if I'm remembering correctly, I don't think they're important at these light of masses because the Compton length of the field is so long. But it certainly is relevant in general. I think most of the fall off comes from the fact that the heavier I make the mass, so those plots were fixing the abundance of the field to some fraction of the CDN density. And so if I have a heavier mass, I need a smaller field value, which reduces the effect. Yeah.
Do the electron fluctuations, cosmologically speaking, remain adiabatic?
Certainly, the scalar only acquires adiabatic fluctuations. We have like almost any. Anything you hear about scalar fields or axions in cosmology, we're just assuming the inflationary scale is low enough that isocurvature is irrelevant. I can't imagine the electron fluctuations doing anything particularly funny. Certainly not during the CMB when the field is just homogeneous, in effect. Okay. All right, now CMB. So this is a plot of the CMB, temperature power spectrum. As I vary the electron mass 20% in either direction, and I fix all other parameters, obviously this is a gigantic change relative to the tiny error bars that I didn't even bother showing because they're so small. But if you look at it, there's kind of some like self-similarity between the curves that may lend hope that there's a degeneracy, which, of course, I already told you there is a degeneracy, but there could be a parameter direction in lambda CDM that could cause these curves to all collapse in each other. So the first thing I'd have to do is get the position of the first peak in the right spot, because that is one of the things that is best measured by CMB observations. I'm just going to skip, since we're getting a little on time, I'm just going to skip over a lot of these details and the sound horizon, I mentioned it earlier, it's the ratio of the co-moving size of the sound horizon to the co-moving distance to recombination. It turns out a lot of these integrals you can do analytically, but then you can squiggle them out and find that you find roughly how they go with the various parameters. So the long story short is that the sound horizon will be smaller if A sub star, which is the scale factor at recombination, is itself smaller. So if recombination happens earlier, A star and therefore the sound horizon are both smaller. The sound horizon is also sensitive to when, relatively speaking, matter radiation equality occurred compared to the time of recombination. And also, the baryon-photon ratio. And then the distance to, again, you know, the distance to last scattering goes like 1 on h naught, and then, you know, also kind of depends on the matter density too.
Sorry, I'm still confused. The answer to Salim was, because it's rolling, it will have anisotropies in it too, but you're saying it's very small, so it won't be like the mass will be different in one.
So, right. So, okay. So these effects, even if there were an effect on the electron fluctuations, the electrons contribute 1/1000th of the energy density to the baryons, to the you know, because they're just 1,000 times lighter than the proton. So you know, their relative contribution to the fluctuations in the baryons is unimportant. And then of course the fluctuations in the scalar themselves are going to be order 10 to the minus 5, just because that's what the adiabatic fluctuations are. You might be worried about the Thompson scattering, but it turns out that Thompson scattering is only sensitive to fluctuations in the electrons at second order in perturbation theory. So even there, the electron fluctuations are subleading effect.
The mass of electron will fluctuate, but it is, well, it will be very small.
Yeah. Okay, so all I have to say about this is that I can dial H naught to keep the sound horizon in the right place, and so that's what I'm going to do. There are these other two quantities in the numerator turn out to measure the other physical effects in the shape of the CMB. Namely, there's the radiation driving effect, which is how the dynamics of the metric potentials change as the CDM becomes more and more important. And then there's the R star is the baryon to photon ratio evaluated at recombination, and that effectively measures how important the baryons are to the photon baryon plasma oscillations, and that affects the relative heights of the peaks, since we take a snapshot of them at some fixed time. So, if I just increase the baryon and the CDM densities to compensate to keep these two numbers the same, then that turns out to be all I need to do to keep the CMB the same, aside from adjusting Hubble to you know, shift everything from left to right accordingly. These changes are, you know, again, like 20% shifts in the electron mass either way, and, you know, virtually no change in the CMB at all. One other thing I didn't mention is the damping scale, and it's a bit cumbersome to see just because there's a lot of factors that go into the diffusion damping scale, but it just turns out if you write everything out and plug in the Thompson scattering cross section, that, you know, you basically find that the damping scales in proportion to the sound horizon, so its relative position on the sky does not change. So that's why you're not seeing any modulation to the diffusion damping on small scales here. And I'll mention, I haven't mentioned the possibility of varying the fine structure constant. That is another thing that you could try to do to make recombination happen earlier. But this is the thing that breaks. The Thompson scattering cross-section scales like, I didn't write it, but it scales like fine structure constant squared in the numerator, whereas the electron mass is in the denominator, and that turns out to be the reason why you can't hold the damping scale in the right spot on the sky as you try to make recombination happen earlier via the fine structure constant. Okay, and then the last thing I'll discuss is low redshift distances. And for just the sake of discussion, I'm going to take an extremely simplified description of these, where I'm just going to show these gray points with error bars are various BAO distance measurements relative to what you would measure in lambda CDM. So, you know, the line one is the prediction of lambda CDM. And as I vary the electron mass along this full degeneracy direction. So I'm also adjusting the baryon density and the CDM density in Hubble. I do get divergence in what the predictions for the BAO scale would be measured as across redshift. So this is the problem that prompted the original proposal for varying electron mass to invoke non-zero spatial curvature to try to fix this up. So as I framed it earlier, the distance to the effect of the redshift at which I'm measuring the BAO scale and however I'm doing that can we factor out into an overall scale that I have to calibrate by knowing the sound horizon, and then an integral over the shape of the expansion history out to the time at which I'm measuring whatever galaxies and whatnot. All these BAO measurements map out for me the trajectory of the expansion history at late times. But if I don't assume that I know what the sound horizon is, which in this case I'm not, then I don't know what the overall scale of that, of the distance measurements that I infer, I don't know what that overall scale is. And so the original proposal is to add curvature, but recall a moment ago I tried to argue that complementary probes mean I need to have the scalar field contribute meaningfully to the CDM density, but it only does so at late times. When it's frozen at early times, it's acting like dark energy, but it is very subdominant component of the universe. And then as soon as it starts to oscillate, it becomes like matter and has some relative contribution that I argued has to be order percent level to 10%. And the real problem here is that I've misbalanced the amount of matter and dark energy. I've misbalanced capital omega M, which is effectively the thing that distance measurements tell me. And so I have more dark energy than I want relative to the amount of matter I want. And that's where the scalar field comes in. It becomes matter-like when it starts oscillating and is another knob that allows me to compensate for the amount to which I increase the dark energy density. So there's a lot of words. So just as a picture, I have my typical lambda CDM constituents. In red, I've got the radiation. In yellow-orange, I've got the CDM and the CDM and the baryons. And then the green curve is the dark energy, and then in blue I have the scalar. And so, I'm not really at the level of the background cosmology, I'm not really changing anything at early times because the scalar is so subdominant. But then I, increase the CDM, the net matter density by, 10% in this plot. As soon as it starts to oscillate. And that's what allows me to effectively put this epoch of matter-dark energy equality in the right spot as far as distance measurements want me to.
Sorry, question. What are the free parameters that you have here?
The free parameters that I have here for the scalar?
Yeah.
I mean, as far as this plot is concerned, just the overall amplitude of the blue curve, which is just determined by its initial condition. And then I can move the point at which it starts oscillating from left to right if I adjust its mass.
So it's like electrons acting like electrons acting like
that. Right, so you have two parameters, and it's the mass and the density,
mm-hmm.
or this initial value of I. And then in addition to that, you couple it to electrons. So that's there are three parameters.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but The mass is essentially, the mass is kind of irrelevant. I don't really have any probes between recombination and redshift of like a few, so I'm not really concerned with whether it starts to oscillate, at redshift of 500 or redshift of 50. So for all of our analysis, at least what I'll show here, I just fix a fiducial mass somewhere in that region, and it doesn't really have much effect on the results.
Wouldn't the shape of the power spectrum constrain the mass, right? Because for these sort of light masses, the species is acting like matter, but it's unclustered on small scales, and so therefore
yeah.
it suppresses the matter power spectrum similar to neutrinos.
Yeah, I'll touch on that in a little bit.
Okay.
Okay, I'll try to get there. So, yeah, by okay. So this is just a modification of the early one, showing that yeah, as I add in a proportionate amount of CDM contribution from the scalar field, I'm able to collapse all the curves for different electron masses onto the lambda CDM prediction. So this tells me that that this extended parameter space where I have the scalar contribute meaningfully to the energy density also achieves the degeneracy with the with say BAO data. Okay. I have a knob, so I didn't have to dial the knob to make the relative contribution of the scalar, be proportionate to the shift in the electron mass. But, this is showing the existence of a degeneracy if that is a knob, and so I should expect it to be what's favored by the data. Okay. Now I'll talk about results. I had to put scalars in class, and it was a bit harder than you might expect. End of story. Okay. So it turns out that the CMB prefers late recombination. The CMB prefers late recombination and no dark energy by itself. So I'm showing results for the scalar field model, but this turns out to be completely unchanged if I just take the vanilla early recombination model, varying electron mass without any scalar field. These are my joint posterior plots showing these narrow bands are the way that a degeneracy looks. I clearly have this degeneracy bearing out in my data, the red point is the lambda CDM best fit values, and Hubble wants to live anywhere below that. Let's zoom in. Hopefully that, I guess it's a bit small, but so the posterior for H is centered at 45 with error bars like 12 or 13. That's lying along some direction with decreasing electron mass, so later recombination. The amount of in this case, the scalar field's contribution to CDM is irrelevant, so I won't even talk about it. I will warn you that before I move on, I will just warn you that the prior is no longer negligible like we're used to in this era of precision cosmology. Standard analyses sample uniformly in theta sub s, actually, so they use theta sub s, the angular size of the sound horizon, as the parameter from which you infer Hubble. But doing so actually imposes a 1 on h prior, which is irrelevant if you've got really small error bars coming from the data, but is definitely not irrelevant if you don't, which we don't. This turns out to be necessary to do from computational efficiency of MCMC, but anyway. This analysis disfavoring larger Hubble is coming from this prior. What's going on here? Was there a question before I explain why the CMB is preferring this? Yeah.
Just to make sure, so the earlier story, the Japanese story where you have this degeneracy, you make things work, that was essentially a fit now, but what you've done here is you program scalar evolution in the count, so either you were doing it where it was oscillating at some point.
Yeah.
So the difference between this and that Japanese story is to do with that scalar dynamic.
Oh, no, this applies to that story. They just didn't say. I don't know why, but so the H-on Olympics paper did do the CMB only analysis. That adding MBAO, as I'll try to show in a minute, really changes the story, but the original paper only showed that combined analysis. If you look buried in an appendix in the Olympics paper, they have this posterior. You can see it, but they don't mention it. I can answer another question, but I can also try to explain why this is happening. So I was really deceiving you earlier by plotting the CMB on a linear x scale. There is not a perfect degeneracy. There's a perfect degeneracy at L greater than, I don't know, 100, but you know, if I zoom in at low L, there's along this degeneracy direction that I discussed earlier, there's definitely effect. This is coming from the late integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect, which we normally consider to be, you know, more or less irrelevant to the CMB. It's on super cosmic variance limited scales, and you know, we're never going to measure these scales more precisely than we already have. But when the rest of the CMB is completely irrelevant, when you have a degeneracy that just does not change the CMB at all, then this is the only thing telling you anything about the model. So, you know, and you know, if you indulge in some chi by I, it kind of looks like all of these points are skewing low. And so that's why, you know, these high electron mass and high Hubble curves in yellow are being disfavored. This is just a known anomaly in CMB data that I'm not telling you to believe is a real thing that is telling us the electron mass was lighter at early times. This is just what's in the data, and this is how I have to interpret the results. And indeed, if I like plot some posterior samples from my MCMC runs and color them by Hubble, you can kind of see higher Hubble, darker colors are skewing up. Lower Hubble, you know, I mean, this is literally so low that there is no dark energy density. Those are the ones that are being preferred, and that's because they're skewing low here. And so the takeaway is that modified recombination can address anomalies in the CMB data and in principle improve the fit, but not in the parameter space that increases H-naught. So I said way at the beginning, you know, the actual way that it compare models is by combining some measure of tension metrics along with the Bayes factors for, you know, how much I improve the marginal likelihood for individual data sets. At least that's one way to phrase it. And I have to do those things in the same parameter space. Otherwise, I haven't actually solved any problems. So when you add, since I'm way out of time, you know, if you add MBAO distances, you get the story that we already knew from the, you know, the original early recombination proposal, which is, you know, I get some, you know, percent level measurement of the electron mass at early times. You can see that this correlation between the, you know, relative contribution of the scalar to CDM and the electron mass being slightly heavier, that degeneracy direction that I argued for a minute ago, indeed, you know, slightly bears out in the parameter inference. Yeah.
So the BAO is in tension with CMB for this one?
Yes. In cosmologies where you essentially just make the sound horizon free, the CMB seems to prefer a universe without dark energy, which is in tension with every other probe that we have of late times. I don't want to say anything too strong right now, but you know, this paper will eventually come out, and I will have some discuss. We'll discuss how much this can be sort of generalized to other such scenarios. So you know, it's the usual story. Broaden the error bars on Hubble. Don't really shift the center to higher H. So you know, that's what I get. But of course, at the same time, this is interesting because these are also just BSM fields particles that could be part of our universe, and so now we have some additional constraints on them. To Neil's question earlier, the scalar free streams on like really huge scales because they're so light, and that does suppress the growth of structure, and because these are so exceptionally light, they can suppress the growth of structure on scales that the sigma 8 measure is sensitive to. And as people in the past have argued or have, you know, found, generally parameter directions that increase Hubble also increase the matter density. And so that's like this black direction I've outlined, which is why people say you can't really solve these two tensions simultaneously. But the free streaming effect of the scalar opens up this, you know, some degree of parameter space in blue to be compared to the gray region that's, you know, along the orthogonal direction, precisely due to this free streaming effect. Okay, I'm just going to close there. Thanks for letting me go a bit over time.
Okay, so maybe we have time for one or two questions. Though there have been many. Okay.
So just the takeaway for that CMB story was essentially that what you were finding was what the Olympic people found, but your conclusion was different because of your Bayesian measure was different?
No, so I haven't actually done the conclusions that I draw from just doing a sort of vanilla parameter inference are not, they don't motivate doing the harder analysis of doing the Bayes factor. It's just that I just don't think anyone has noticed this, or at least not to the extent that they discussed it in the papers. You can see, I mean, it's a very broad, the posteriors are very broad. So, you know, when you add on the BAO data, you essentially just get a little region here. And I don't know that anyone has looked into why the degeneracy direction only goes downward in Hubble in electron mass and not also upward. Because in principle, from everything I argued, it should just go on nearly forever. But it doesn't.
Just on that previous point, have you quantified what it means, like whether if the lower values of electron mass are, like how much you resolve these anomalies?
I'm not exactly sure how I would do that. I do know that, you know, within this, you know, free sound horizon cosmology, that this bottom curve here is about as good as I can do in reducing the amplitude. Like that's basically showing you no late ISW effect because there's basically no dark energy in that model. So we just live in a matter-dominated universe.
Okay. Maybe since there is another seminar like at one, maybe you can ask at lunch, I suggest.
Yeah, I'm here tomorrow too. Happy to talk.
Okay, so let's thank the speaker again.